What's going on, everybody? This is Nick Zappanero for another episode of the Divvy Crypto Podcast. Today, we have a very special guest, Mr. Robert Hirsch, who's actually been a very long-term participant in the Divvy economy and has become a good friend of mine. And today, we're going to be talking about a news article that came out last week about quantum supremacy. Google has actually claimed to achieve quantum supremacy, which puts a lot of questions in the minds of those who are, of course, in crypto, but all across the tech world as far as encryption goes. Because if quantum computers exist, that also might mean that encryption is no longer safe. So, Robert, thanks for joining me.
Oh, you're welcome. It's great. I'm great. Glad to be here.
Yeah, definitely. So as you just heard me say, you know, Google has claimed to have achieved quantum supremacy. This is obviously an incredible feat for them. But what do you think this means for us in crypto and really the tech world as a whole?
Sure. That's the answer to that is pretty long because, you know, they made this announcement and, you know, a lot of people are still like, well, you know, what are quantum computers? And so there's a lot of kind of background. So in order to answer that well, I want to maybe step back a bit and kind of talk about the background of quantum computers and quantum computing. But the first thing to know about it really is like a quote from Carl Sagan from a while ago, and I didn't bring it up, but it's something to this effect. This was back, I think, in the 70s, where he was talking about like on the planet, there's like 12 people who understand quantum mechanics, right? And the things that happen inside quantum computers. Now, you know, it's like, you know, 40 or 50 years later, I'm not really sure when he said this quote, but so maybe there's more than 12. But the fact of the matter is, what's actually going on in these quantum computers and the way qubits work and the way quantum computers work in general, really most people really do not know the answer to this. And I'm going to include myself in that. Right. I really don't know. I wouldn't be able to design one. I wouldn't be able to work with one. But there's also people who don't know how engines work and they can still drive a car. Right. So people kind of can understand the way what quantum computing can do without understanding necessarily what's happening underneath the hood. So for, you know, decades, people around the world have been fascinated by qubits, which are really quantum bits, which are both one and zero at the same time. And the process of anything that that requires combinatorial kind of assessment. So this is drug discovery, cryptography, things like that. Quantum computers are really good at because they're combinatorial in nature. That doesn't mean quantum computers are good for everything. So when the history has been like, oh, well, we have 4 qubits and we have, you know, 8 qubits. And there's actually a couple websites where you can see the progress that we've made. And the most qubits that we have right now is from a group, starts with a B, it's escaping me. It's 128 qubits. But that doesn't mean that they actually have the ability to run a quantum computer with all 128. What Google did was they ran one with 53, and they gave it a problem that quantum computers are specifically good at. And they ran it, and they said, well, you know, look, it would take a normal computer a bazillion years to do this, and our quantum computer did it in, like, you know, a matter of seconds, and thus we've achieved quantum supremacy. And they're not lying. Right. They have. That problem was harder for normal computers. But the ramifications on our daily life isn't so huge quite yet. So what you'll see is anything, if you look in the literature, it's pretty amazing. You'll see everything from head in the sand kind of quantum computers will never, ever happen. I was just reading an article about this a couple of days ago, to, oh my God, all cryptography is shot next year. So that's really the range that you're dealing with when you're reading stuff on the internet. So the answer to your question is, from my point of view, is I hate to be kind of loosey-goosey about this, but it's really, but I believe it's honestly somewhere in the middle. and we can discuss the challenges, but there's a number of challenges before cryptocurrencies are endangered. Is there any questions on that stuff? Because I can go a little bit further into this.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a remarkable explanation. I really appreciate you diving into that. I mean, it's obviously something that, like you said, most people just don't understand, even the baseline of quantum mechanics, let alone quantum computing. And it's really easy to get lost in the deluge of information that exists out there, especially with the internet, where we know everything is always true.
Right. That's what actually, and we didn't have the internet when Carl Sagan was around, but that's what he was pointing at. He was actually pointing at all these people that were equating vibrations with quantum mechanics and their healing energy. And he's like, wait a second, you know, nobody understands this stuff. So, you know, if we're going to talk about quantum mechanics, let's actually talk about the real quantum mechanics, right?
Right.
But what's happened now is, you know, these are real technologies, and there is a threat. There's an imminent threat, and maybe imminent is too strong of a word, but there is a threat. You could call it like a Y2K thing, right? People talked about it. And there was a wide range of disaster scenarios that had to do with Y2K. I was watching some guy talking about how like nothing was going to work. You're going to pick up the phone. Like, we didn't have cell phones at the time so much, and there would be no dial tone and the lights are going to go out. And literally this guy was saying that, on news.
I was young, but I remember.
Right. and the answer is, basically nothing happened. But the reason why nothing happened was because people spent $400 billion preparing for it. It could have been maybe less money if people had acted earlier and so on and so forth. But the same is true with quantum computers. There's a date in the future where they will be able to wrangle up enough qubits to crack Bitcoin as it currently lives today, as it, in its instance, the way it's constructed today. We use SHA 256, and in order to crack that, you need, I believe you need 512 qubits, right? We're the best we have right now is 128. But the big issue is they are so error prone, finicky little bastards that, I mean, honestly, it's very, very difficult to make quantum computers and make bigger and bigger ones. So there are a lot of studies that saying, okay, you need to crack Bitcoin because of this particular encryption we're using, you need this many qubits. But the reality is you need way more. And when I say way more, some of the studies are saying you need thousands or millions to be able to do it and use all of those with error correction schemes in order to crack it. We're not close to that yet, right?
So yeah, from my understanding, you know, that would just burn out your pretty much any modern motherboard, right? You need as much, let's call it deterministic RAM as you have qubits, and as that increases, it's exponential and right. Just starts to, I mean, there's no cooling in the world. You'd have to put it in like a, some sort of freezer or something.
Right. So that's, I mean, qubits are right now, they're already heavily refrigerated. They're down at like 4 Kelvin or something. They're really, really cold. So all of these predictions about whether they're useful or non-useful and so forth, or how far away they are. Let's say they're 10 years away. That's like the standard, we don't know answer. It's 10 years away. You know, fusion's been 10 years away for like 30 years. Bitcoin absolutely, in theory, could be cracked, but not with these things that we have now. But what happens next year? Let's say somebody comes up with a high temperature qubit. Or let's say somebody next year is able to manufacture qubits at millions a day. The answer changes, right? So right. I'm not saying any of that stuff is happening. I'm saying the predictions that we have right now are based on the technology that we have right now, and there are things that could change those predictions pretty drastically. So, you know, I don't think Bitcoin, you know, or Divi is in danger this year or next year. I think it's in danger some year, it's going to happen, and it needs to adapt. And so one way to adapt is to move off of SHA-256 and go to something else. Another way to adapt is to just get off of that type of encryption and go to other types of encryption. Already some chains are working on that. And then you fork, you know, and you adapt to it. So there is a path that gets us there. And so I'm a little bit less worried in terms of, actually, when I first was studying this, I was worried about cryptocurrency. It's like, will the value be zero tomorrow? Because if you think about who's building them, like Google is publishing what they're doing because they have to boost their brand, right? But China is investing heavily, really heavily in quantum computers. They are, the rate of increase of spending on quantum computers in China is higher than the United States, but the actual spending currently is higher in the United States. So they're catching up, is the shorter way to say that. And they're not going to publish how far they are, right? One day, right, Encryption will be cracked and we won't know. You know, like,
yeah, well, yeah, definitely. And it, of course, it's in the best interests of their signal intelligence and their, I guess more so their cyber intelligence, not to say how far along they are. I mean, it could be tomorrow, right? Shenzhen just comes out and says,
yeah,
oh, we got you.
Yeah. And the reason why Bitcoin is bad is not bad, but Bitcoin is vulnerable is because it's very specific.
Right.
Like like we know we need this specific thing to crack Bitcoin. It doesn't mean like all encryption is bad, because if you don't have information about the encryption, then the quantum computer doesn't really help so much, right? If you know something is encrypted this specific way, then your quantum computer is helpful. If you don't know how it's encrypted, you know, what type of encryption, the length of encryption, is there one set of keys, two sets of keys, all that kind of stuff, you know, it becomes much harder. There is a human element that is required to get the other information in order to crack it.
Right.
So that's really the, so I'm not alarmist about quantum computers. I think it's realistic to say we as a community, crypto community, you know, we as, you know, scientists and governments and so forth have to be very aware that this is happening. And we're heading towards this, but it, you know, I don't think it's tomorrow. I don't think it's next year either.
But we do want to avoid a Y2K situation where we're spending hundreds of millions or billions of dollars to let's say play catch up,
right,
in order to prevent, you know, the inevitable.
So, right.
So what do we do in the meantime? What can you know, cryptocurrency developers do? What can cybersecurity engineers do in order to sort of take proactive steps in order to prevent the inevitable?
So I can answer, I can toot our own horn a little bit on that, which I'll get to in a second, because I happen to work at a company that protects data from quantum computers. So that, but that's,
you don't
not,
say.
Yeah, how strange. and I'll get to that in a second. But it doesn't help. What we do doesn't really help cryptocurrencies, because the keys are static and the addresses are public, right? So if I am China and I have actually made 512 stable qubits, I'm going to point it at Satoshi's wallet. I will definitely do that. Right. And I will be able to get those keys. There's not even a question whether I can do that or not. That if I have the capacity and capability to do it, and I don't like Bitcoin, or I want it to be valued zero tomorrow, I'm going to take the funds out of there. So that is definitely something I am personally worried about. A lot of people in crypto talk about, well, you know, you change your address and you know, and while the funds are in motion, it's quantum secure, and all of that is true. But the fact of the matter is, when funds are not in motion, when they are sitting at an address, they're vulnerable, and there isn't a way to get around it because the address is public, and you can retrieve the private keys with a quantum computer. So, what can they do about that is they, I mean, obviously with time, the encryption methods need to change. And we should pay attention to some of the blockchains that are paying that are dealing with that now. I think there's one called QRL. And there might be a couple other ones. That's the one that's coming to my mind. And implement them. I mean, you know, Bitcoin can change. It has changed, you know, many times, and it can continue to advance. And I believe as computers can handle more encryption or different encryption, they should incorporate it. You know, there's an asset to protect there. The bigger fear is not cryptocurrency. Right now, if you look at the world economy, cryptocurrency is a small amount, right? It's I think Apple's worth more than all of cryptocurrency or something like that. I think you mentioned that.
That's one. Right. They have more cash on hand than the entire market cap, pretty much.
That's right. That's right. So it's not, I mean, cryptocurrencies, you know, having a value of zero, like this, let's say like this bizarre scenario happens and China gets this tomorrow and they steal enough crypto to really say that, wow, all of this blockchain stuff is for naught, right? And so it's worth zero. But the effect of that on the world won't be very much. The effect on that on the world comes where all our corporations' encrypted data is vulnerable, or the American government's encrypted data is vulnerable. And we already know that other governments are copying encrypted text so that later they can decrypt it, right? We've already seen like Chinese fighter planes look identical to ours. And some of that is decrypting encryption. Some of it is just phishing and stealing. But once these things are around and usable for whatever, you know, again, 5 years, 10 years, 30 years, I don't know the answer to that. The things we rely on encryption for, that's what's vulnerable, and that's what we can start fixing today. It's relatively a simple process, and that's, again, so here I go. I'm going to toot my horn here. So the company I work at specifically addresses data at rest, protecting data at rest from quantum computers. It has a bunch of other features to help with other aspects of data security, but one of the features of it is that we use encryption, but it's like a speed bump for us. The problem with encryption is that the data is under there. The encrypted text is in the same location as the actual data that you want. So if I want to steal stuff, you know, I just have to decrypt where this stuff is. And what our company does basically is dislocate the data from the place where you use the data. And so we use the word, it's really tokenizing the data. However, I don't want to confuse that with tokens that are on blockchains and stuff. It's the same word with the same meaning sort of, but it's not, you know, it's not the same thing. So we basically move the data somewhere else. We fragment it. We mix it up with a bunch of other data. And we can't even access the data. You need to be, I'll get into the authentication in a second, but basically, and then we put a token where the data is going to be used. So whenever you want to use the data, here's the token, you're authorized to access the data, and there's a set of pointers that pull the data back together just for you. This means a government could come in or somebody can hack into the servers or whatever, and all they'll see is gobbledygook. There's no way to... The data fragments are decoupled from each other. There's no way to use one fragment to get to another one. And it's all mixed up with other people's data, and it's all encrypted. So it's all gobbledygook, and you don't know where one starts. No one can know where one starts or one ends, except for the person who's authorized. The pointer list is literally created from the authentication process. And frankly, we don't like passwords either, and we don't like hardware keys. We don't like something you know, and we don't like something you have in order to access the data. Both of those are vulnerable to guns. Let's put it that way, right?
Yeah. We call it the $5 wrench attack.
Right, exactly. So we don't like either of those. What we do like is something you do. So biometrics are good. but they're not perfect, right? So even Face ID and Touch ID, they're, you know, they're vulnerable to the wrench. But something that you do, the way you put in your password or the way you use your computer, so that's what we have. We use behavioral biometrics to access the data. And so as you're using your computer, the way you use your mouse, where you are, the equipment that you're using, all of that stuff, that's the only way to get to your data. And so our platform kind of puts all of that together. So it provides the quantum resistance because, as an example, cars are a really good example in license plates. So license plates, they represent a lot of data, right? But you can point a quantum computer at a license plate as much as you want, and you will not retrieve any data at all from it, right? It's just a number that's got nothing to do with your driving history or whatever. You have to link to it from another avenue, right? Right now, a cop can do it, right? But a cop can't also get other things that he's not authorized for. So it's the same kind of model that way. So the token, which is sitting in the place where you use the data, the place that you would attack, isn't the data itself, as opposed to encrypted data, where it is the data itself. It just looks funny, and you just need to decrypt it. So that's basically the way we make data quantum proof, or quantum safe, we call it. You know, nothing is proof.
right, of course.
All right, so that was a long, boring explanation of how we do it. But the point is, you know, we were talking about in crypto, how do we protect it? Our stuff, the only way our stuff really protects crypto is by protecting the keys, and it's really a contemporary way. So we can store your keys. We can use the biometrics for you to retrieve the keys, or if it's keys or seed words or whatever, you know, so that it's safe in a redundant, encrypted, fragmented, quantum safe area. Very hard, you know, that only you can get at, because only you behave the way that you behave to gain access to it. That's what we can offer now. So it is quantum safe. And it, you know, it's a lot easier than what most people do for their keys, which is like have a little Dropbox file that says keys, you know.
Right? Oh God, please no.
Yeah. Right. So, I mean, we can train people all we want, but ultimately they get lazy. So what you want is a solution that really allows people to be lazy, but is very secure. And I think that's what we're offering. We're saying, okay, you can store keys with us. We can't even get them. And the way you use your computer gives you access to those keys. And so it appeals to the lazy and the secure at the same time. So that's
really interesting. So the way that you, let's say, the speed at which you type in your username and password, is that what you mean by your behavior?
Yeah, it's not just the speed, right? It's so we, you know, there's kind of two aspects. So like if there's a kind of a log on kind of single event, then it's like, do you normally use the right shift key or the left one? You know, and you know, what is the timing between each letter that you put in? So it's not just I put my password in you know, 2.2 seconds. It's how much time between each key, which key came after which shift or which control or which, you know, it's a little bit more complicated. And then also depending on the particular usage from it for it, you know, whether it's a wallet or whether it's like, you know, we're doing another Dropbox or whatever, depending on the usage, we may also add in location and what device you're doing. I mean, so there's a bunch of stuff that we can use to make an anonymous profile of you. And that is what will give you access. It's virtually impossible for somebody to copy all of this stuff at once. So you can just be you, access your data, and then you can give, like we have demos of this, you can give somebody your password and they still cannot get in because they will not put in the password the same way you do.
Wow, that's incredible. So my question is, you know, this is obviously a really good solution for a really difficult problem that everyone, not just Divi, not just Bitcoin, but every single cryptocurrency is facing right now. And I get asked this question all the time on other interviews and other podcasts, which is, you know, how do you defeat the $5 wrench?
Yeah.
And I honestly never really have the best answer, but this sounds like an amazing answer. So like, how easy is it to integrate this into an existing platform? Is it a huge undertaking as far as
technical goes? I don't think it's that bad. I mean, it's a set of API calls, you know, which you guys are pretty used to already, you know, and that's kind of it. You do have to set up kind of like, you know, either like the cryptocurrency project themselves or the people using the wallets. We haven't really decided how we're going to do this yet. It's on a case by case kind of thing about who is signing up onto our platform. You know, whether it's the users or whether it gets, or whether the company's acting as a conduit, it totally depends on how we're doing it. But yeah, if you offer Cloak as a, I don't think I ever mentioned the name of the company, but it's Cloak with K's. it's spelled, you know, like, you know, the 5-year-old way. It's K-L-O-K-E. you would offer it through your wallet. People would sign up for Cloak and get a their authentication credentials in there, you know, name, password, that kind of stuff. And then hopefully never have to use those again. and then you just pass the API through to, and if people want to use it, they can use it. And if they don't, they don't.
Well, that's fantastic. I definitely am interested in integrating this with Divi. I think everybody, honestly, all the developers out there should be considering this solution or something like it, because as you said, toward the midsection of this podcast, it's inevitable. Right, we're going to see quantum computing one way or another, whether it's Google or China or some guy in his basement. Someone's going to crack the code, and it's going to become a reality. So, where can we find Cloak online? And are you guys ready for people to start reaching out to you now? Where are you guys at in the process?
So, we're still pretty early on, So we definitely offer people to work with us for beta projects. So a wallet user wouldn't use us yet, but you guys might, right? And we would test test the integration and then release it if you guys like it. But that we're basically doing beta trials now with different customers, I don't have a date that I can tell people. You're used to this, right? about when we're going to be production ready. But we're offering kind of like, beta level kind of trials, for now.
Awesome. Well, I'm definitely going to reach out to you after the call and make sure we get that set up.
Awesome.
But, before we close down here, is there anything else that you wanted to mention? I know you're a writer. Do you want to link people to your work?
I don't know. You know, like it's true. I think I might be twice your age. And like as I kind of left working and so forth, I'm still trying to figure out what I want to be when I grow up. And so this Cloak stuff showed up, this crypto stuff showed up. I started writing a couple of books. If you like sci-fi, I've got a few. If anybody wants to beta read, I'd love to send out a few of those books and see if I can ultimately get those published. I do have a couple of self-published things which were marginally successful, but you know, you have to like, I think one was, two of them are steampunk novels. And actually it's funny, you see the show on Amazon, this Carnival Row show, have you seen that?
Yeah.
It's not my story, but it's almost identical with, you know, kind of steampunky kind of gritty town and, you know, fairyland. It's bizarre to see a show like that has virtually the same premise as the book that I wrote.
That's so crazy.
But
you getting royalties on that?
Yeah, no, it's the second time that happened. It's funny because when I was younger, this was in the 90s, me and two other guys, we developed this GPS watch long before GPS was in watches. And I was like, because I started running and I'm like, this sucks. I don't know how far I went, how fast I'm going. And then I'm like, but I think we can shrink GPS into a big watch. and we designed it, and we got, you know, we got the functionality working, and we were looking for it, and we presented it, and we won some business plan competitions. And then the very first Timex Garmin, what the hell is the name of that watch that they first came out with? Now it's escaping me because I'm mad at them. But it looked identical. It was identical. It had the same font on the graphics
screen. No. And no patent on it, I'm assuming.
No. And that was another story. It's why at the time I was patenting. We tried to patent it. And, you know, at the time, the patent system was a little different. It was, you put your patent in, it went into this black hole for 18 months. And then, you know, maybe you got a patent on the outside, on the other end of that. Now you can see what's in the black hole. You couldn't see that before. So we, you know, it was, you know, the landscape was clear. We had this great idea for this GPS watch and all the way, the functionality and the way it reported and so forth. And so we put the, you know, we spent thousands of dollars and we put the patent in. And then 1 month later, a patent popped out. That was basically the same idea, kind of like done differently. It was done like in a Walkman instead of on a watch, but the claims pretty much covered what we want to do. And then like 2 months later, another one. And then 3 months later, another one. And we were like, forget this, you know? So we dropped that. And I, you know, it was the cause of a lot of depression and sadness. But, you know, it was, that sort of thing happens to me a lot. I think of things too late.
Oh man, that's so tough. You know, yeah. And that's a big reason. You know, you never really know like who's watching. You know, obviously you can't necessarily prove that Garmin took your idea, but in a way they did, you know, and it's possible that they did see that. I actually have a buddy who has been working on an adaptive clothing line for amputees. He unfortunately lost his leg in an accident. And so, but he's very athletic. So he's created this line of clothing that is made for adaptive athletes, people that have amputations. Uh-huh. And he had a provisional patent on it and he was about to let it go. And it was mainly because no one else was doing it. And he kind of lost faith in the idea. He's like, well, if nobody else is doing it, it must not be a good idea. Oh, and then
backwards.
One of the, right, exactly. One of, I was like, you have one of, you know, the most rare unicorn ideas, something that no one else is doing. But he ends up seeing on one of the sportswear websites, I don't remember exactly which company, Champion or one of those, an adaptive sportswear line that was about to release. And he's like, wait a minute, no. So he quickly goes and, you know, and files the full patent on the clothing. But that just goes to show you never really know who's on the lookout and who's watching what you're doing. And I think it's especially important that that crypto companies are taking note of this, because if you watched what happened in the last basically tech boom, the companies that became huge, like Microsoft, Apple, Facebook, even they started filing patents on stuff that was probably someone else's idea that they had no intention of actually following through on. And there's this really sort of stigma around trademarking or patenting things in crypto. But I think, and I'm leading up to a question here, I think it's important that companies do actually file these patents on their technology. But where do you stand with that? Have been having your own technology mimicked and your own ideas mimicked. Do you think that that's important?
You're talking to a voluntarist. So my views on patents have radically changed. So I was, you know, 15 years ago, I was 100% with you. Like, you have an idea, you need to patent it, and so on and so forth. And I totally agree that we have a patenting system, and if you want to be successful within it, that you need to patent. And you know, Cloak has patents. That, you know, we have I think it's 10 patents protecting all of our stuff. So, you know, I'd be hypocritical to say you shouldn't be having a patent. The fact of the matter is the system right now supports that method. Philosophically, or maybe morally, I'm adamantly against patents. I think they help the wrong people. Not you, right? But you know, we talk about, we want to live in a world where everybody has a good idea, and we want the people to benefit from the ideas, right? and locking up an idea in a patent, which is protected, you know, distantly, but ultimately by guns, is just not a healthy society. We want the ideas to be free. We want people to copy ideas. Copying is good, right? That those are the good ideas we're copying. And so ultimately, so for the good ideas to get out there with to all the people at low prices and so forth, the patenting system really kind of mucks that up. The converse to, so the reality is we have a patenting system. A lot of our economy is based on the fact that we hold people's ideas, protected for 14 to 20 years, depending on what year it is. And so our economy, a lot of our economy is based on this, but I just don't think, I would rather that was not our system. I'd rather our system was open source from top to bottom. And the ideas, you like an idea, you do the idea. And it's totally cool to copy an idea and improve the idea. And I think we just get better dissemination of good ideas on average by doing it that way. But,
of course,
that's not what we have.
Yeah, exactly. Of course, I agree. And we're starting to see even the big companies open sourcing technologies, including Microsoft and Facebook and the like. Not Apple at all, but in fact, they're closing things down even more. Did you see, I might've sent you this article, but it was basically saying if you are a repair person for Apple products, you have to now get an additional certification and use specified parts in order to like authenticate the pieces that you're putting together on the device. And if you don't, the device will actually basically change in some way or send some message back to Apple that says like this device is not legit and kind of voids your warranty. So
yeah, and they're doing that on the
you
glass
have that
screen.
End of the spectrum, I mean, and then you have which is absolutely ridiculous because I cracked my screen recently and I brought it in to the repair guy that I always go to. Been going to the same guy for 4 years, 5 years. Every time I break a device or someone does.
Dude, do you have a problem?
Yeah, right. I used to work in nightlife, so that should tell you everything. So, I bring it into this guy, and it's this small shop, right? He's just trying to make ends meet. His wife has a flower shop on the opposite side of the building, and it's not like he's raking in a ton of money by fixing drunk people's broken phones. He's just trying to make a living. Yeah, and Apple imposes this walled garden, and now it's like a walled garden with barbed wire around the fence because now you can't even not that he's cutting corners, but he is, I'm sure, using aftermarket pieces and things like that in order to make more margins. That's no longer an option, and that's what I hate to see.
I'm going
to
go ahead and talk because it's funny.
Crypto become.
There you are. I lost you for about 7 seconds.
Yeah.
It's funny you actually brought that up in a discussion about patents because that specific thing has nothing to do with patents, right? You can do that without patents. And in fact, that's one way to protect your stuff without a patent system in place at all.
Yeah, I guess this additional level of authentication, but doesn't it have the same effect as forcing people to either license your software or not even have access to the technology?
Well, certainly people like in a non-patent system, people would still protect their ideas, right? And there's a variety of ways. And that particular aspect of Apple is one of the many ways that you can, trade secrets is another way. And there's a bunch of ways you can protect ideas without patents. The big difference, right, is fundamentally when Apple does that, they're not preventing somebody else from doing that. And they're not pointing guns at people to protect it. They're just saying, if you want to use our stuff, these are our rules. And if you don't like it, you can go elsewhere. And the fact of the matter is you can go elsewhere. And so they're risking market share that way. And I hope people bite them for it, honestly. But the entire system, that entire thing and a bunch of other ways are all methods by which you can still protect ideas without patents.
Very true. That's a great point. Well, this has been an enthralling conversation. I love how these conversations start. Like we started with what quantum supremacy in Google, and we ended up talking about patent law and Apple's walled garden. But I think that's what makes these conversations really enjoyable for me and hopefully the people that are listening. So before we sign off, you know, let us know where we can find you online or otherwise.
I'll give you a couple of links afterward, but I think the easy one is cloke.ai. It's cloke.ai. And you can you can probably get a better feel for what we're doing there. I do know that is still, being worked on. So give us a little bit of a break if there's some issues with that website. You know, again, we're a pretty brand new company. The technology we've been working on for over a year, but actually, becoming the company and so forth is relatively recent. That's where we are.
Fantastic. And as you guys know, you can always find Divi at Divi Project on all social media and Telegram, t.me/Divi Project. This has been an amazing episode with Mr. Robert Hirsch, who is an incredibly brilliant PhD who's working on Cloke, a quantum resistant technology that you guys should definitely check out. I know that we'll be looking at beta testing it for Divi, and hopefully some other cryptocurrency projects will do the same. So guys, I will see you on the next episode. Have a great day.
Thanks a lot.